But like the reality is that this is the system that we're dealt as artists, right? The reality is that if you look at the impacts of the music industry, flying and artist travel is not the biggest impact anyway. It's audience travel. You know, there's other impacts that are bigger than the artist traveling, because you're still talking about such a small percentage of the people who are operating the industry who are traveling like that. I mean, streaming, music streaming has an insane carbon footprint, right? Like it's huge. So, and it's bigger than it ever was with CDs or records, even though those are physical products, just because of the amount of energy that's required to operate the servers and the data transfer. On top of that, creating the devices that we use to stream music is also has massive impacts on the environment and the climate, right? So how do we work on changing that system? It's important that we can have these conversations without blaming people or like or canceling people or whatever you want to say about or yelling at each other. These are just like, it's so nuanced and everybody's got their own story. We can't expect everybody to live the same way.
You're listening to the Mission Makers Show, a podcast that inspires humans to get into the mindset of success. My name's Farah Nanji, and I'm the founder of a business in the motorsports industry that explores leadership lessons from things like Formula One. I'm also a DJ and music producer in the underground electronic scene, and a public speaker on key topics like resilience, building high performance teams, overcoming learning difficulties, and stimulating creativity. And to tie it all together, I love writing thought-provoking content as a journalist for these industries which are so unique in themselves. On this show, I'm sitting down with some of the most inspiring and driven people I've met around the world to talk about their processes, their failures, the lessons they've learned, and how they are truly making an impact for this world. Welcome back to Mission Makers. I'm delighted to be joined by Eli Goldstein today, who's widely recognized as one half of the renowned DJ and production duo Soulclap. Now, not only has Eli been a prolific artist for the last two decades, but he's also been using his platform to create wider change as the driving force behind DJs for Climate Action, where he plays an instrumental role in mobilizing the music community to address climate challenges. He's also involved in various initiatives to bridge the worlds of music with social impact and empowerment. And today's conversation is going to touch upon not only the factors of success in the music industry, but the steps every stakeholder can take to create a more healthier ecosystem for our planet. So let's dive in. Eli, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today? Where are you joining me from?
Thanks for having me, Farah. I am beaming in from the beautiful Hudson Valley in upstate New York, where I live.
Something we always like to begin our interviews with here at Mission Makers is kind of going a bit deeper into the meaning of a person's name. So, are you familiar with what Eli means?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, my name is disconnected, I feel like, from its meaning in some ways, in that, I'm Jewish. And my parents chose a Jewish name. However, they're both atheists, so I was not raised religious, but they still chose a Jewish name. I mean, it could be Elias or Elijah the prophet being the biblical significance of the name, but they just chose Eli for me. I think that was their way of being different but still, not being religious with it, but still, having that name. So yeah, it's I'm not sure what the significance it has for me, but I think there's a lot in a name, so it hangs over me without me thinking about it so much, regardless.
And just for context, your from what we research, your name means kind of elevated, ascended, high. Does that resonate?
It used to resonate more. These days, I'm more of a dad than a raver. But yeah, no, I still think, trying to get that natural high.
100%.
And the, I do think like the biblical bit, the prophet part of it, right, is like spreading information and ideas, and music is all very, very important in my life.
Yeah, certainly is. So talking of music, you do form one better half of the duo known as Soulclap.
And you guys have been around for, you know, more than two decades now. So talk to our audience a little bit about where that journey kind of started from and how did it evolve into the missions that you're behind today?
Yeah, so SoulClap started back in 2001, officially in Boston. Myself and Charlie, my longtime partner, are both from the Boston area. I'm from Cambridge, he's from Brookline, opposite sides of the Charles River. And we were introduced by a mutual friend in high school, even before that, in the late 90s, because we were both DJs and both, you know, ravers going out, part of that 90s US rave scene, which was really an incredible culture to grow up in. But you know, at the time there just weren't that many DJs. So our mutual friend, Sour Pete, AKA Vegan Pete, introduced us because he was like, you guys are both DJs, you should know each other. And so, yeah, we ended up, you know, going to some parties together, starting to listen to music, go record shopping together. And ultimately around the early 2000s, we were like, you know, kind of had this shared vision of what we wanted to accomplish musically, you know, coming out of really different flavors of house music, but still shared vision of like house music being this unifying genre, and started sharing a record collection. We were going to the record shops and being like, instead of buying two copies of something, let's just pool our collection and buy one copy so we can get more records. And so we started doing that and, you know, DJing together. I think we had our first official SoulClap gig at a rave in Western Massachusetts in 2001, soon after we came up with the name. And we want to talk about significance of names. SoulClap is an interesting one because, you know, at that time in the early 2000s, the house music scene in Boston was like very Black and Latin, right? It's like, now we're kind of dealing with the opposite, right? Where like electronic music, house music has gotten so white and like has kind of moved away from its roots from these more marginalized communities. And that's part of the discussion now is how do we bring that back and shine a light on that? But at that time it was like, we were the only white boys going out to these parties. And so we're like, yo, what's the name that's gonna get us, you know, the most cred in that circle? And so we came up with SoulClap, and it's been, you know, it's been an important name because it's meant, we always stick to our mission of soulful, uplifting, funky music that you know connects with your spirit has always been part of our musical mission. So that's an important significance of the name.
And how did it kind of evolve into more of the kind of climate stuff that you're very passionate about, making a change in the scene towards?
Yeah, well, I mean, so it was a long slog in Boston, right? We were doing mobile DJing. We started playing like, so we were doing mobile DJing. We were playing in nightclubs, which required a lot of like top 40. And you know, at that time was hip hop, R&B, reggae. But like, you know, always loving house, doing underground parties in Boston with just a few people coming out. And, you know, finally in 2007, we decided to commit to like just focusing on the music we loved and not just doing the other DJing to make a living. And we just started, we got serious about making music, got deep in the studio. Like, look, we'll give it a year. If we don't make any progress, then maybe we need to try to find something else to do. We're in our like, you know, mid 20s by that time. And luckily everything clicked, you know, our friends started a label called Airdrop Records in New York. This was a moment when the scene in the US was like teeny and like so underground, and just, you know, we're a part of that movement that was bubbling in New York and Miami and in Denver and LA and Chicago. Things started happening. And, you know, we started traveling in like 2008, Detroit, and we linked up with Wolf and Lamb in 2009 from the infamous Marcy Hotel parties in New York City. And everything just took off from there. So 2009, we just started traveling around the world. So there was like a good 10 years of that, 2009 to 2019. And, you know, throughout that, I kind of had this feeling that like I needed, like, you know, sharing music and positive vibrations and uplifting people is really an incredible experience and like kind of the most amazing job that, you know, I could ask for. And, but I just felt like I needed to do more, right? Like, I feel like I needed to make a bigger impact beyond just that dance floor, like beyond just the people who had the privilege to be on that dance floor. So climate work kind of found me. And it's funnily enough, I actually had been, you know, this kind of came back to me more recently that I had been like part of this Earth Chorus in the Boston area when I was in elementary school. Like, just like we would go around and sing songs about the environment and the earth, which I didn't really think about until more recently, once like I got deeper on the climate work like that. So I had a start when I was a kid and then didn't really think about it for a long time. And then a friend of mine started an organization called DJs for Climate Action back in around 2012, 13. And it started out as a way for DJs to offset our carbon emissions from flying on like a three-tier system. And I was, you know, really curious, and it kind of piqued my interest as to like what my impacts were. I was like, oh wait, I'm actually having these negative impacts just by flying and pursuing this music career. And so, you know, I connected deeply. His name's Sammy Bananas, Sam Posner, old Boston friend, but has lived in New York for years. And, you know, we connected on that. And then over the years, I got more and more involved with DJs for Climate Action. And I helped found our Earth Night initiative in 2017 or 18. It's now our sixth year doing Earth Night this year. That's coming up in April. And by 2019, you know, I'm one of the, I guess, more high profile artists to talk about this stuff in the electronic music industry. So I was asked to speak on a couple panels at ADE Green back in 2019. And, you know, in preparing for the panels, I realized that I just didn't really know enough to be an expert. And here I'm getting called on to be an expert, but I just wanted to know more. So I started digging. I had recently moved up here to upstate New York. And I was like, look, I wonder what I can do to educate myself, you know, whether it's like some kind of workshops or some kind of program. And it actually turns out that a college right near me, Bard College, has a Center for Environmental Policy with a master's degree in climate science and policy. So I was like, oh, this is cool. I went and visited. And I figured it'd be something I could do down the line, you know, like a couple more years of touring and then look at pivoting more to the climate stuff. And then pandemic happened. And it was like perfect timing. I was like, I managed to get my application in right before the deadline. Had a feeling that it was a good time. Like the touring wasn't going to happen the way it was. It had been, and it was going to take a while to get back. At first, maybe there was this wishful thinking that we were going to get back to normal quickly, but I had a feeling in the back of my head that this was actually a really seismic event for our industry and for my career. And so I started the master's program in September, 2020, and kind of did a full year, the full year of academics. And then last year I just did an internship and then took most of the year off. And now I'm back in since September 2022. I've been working on this thesis. And you know, it's more than just the academic part, right? Like I've spent this time building a really, really wide network of people in the electronic music industry and the music industry in general who care about climate and nature and the environment and are, you know, doing this work. And part of my biggest goal is, you know, how to bring all of us together and work towards our shared vision of protecting our planet and the people on our planet.
Mm. It's kind of humbling to hear, you know, like obviously you've had such success in the music industry, then you pivoted and you took an internship, right? Like that's insane. So like what was that about? Where did you intern and like what were the things that you were required to do?
I interned at an organization called A Greener Festival, which is based in the UK. They do amazing work around sustainability at events and festivals, and they've actually expanded. They do like audits of sustainability audits. So they've actually done O2 Arena recently. So they're a growing company and really look to in the UK and somewhat globally as one of the leaders in these, in, you know, pushing sustainability at events and festivals. Mm-hmm. So for them, I did a lot of work around this initiative on measuring emissions in the electronic music industry. And it was really challenging. I mean, just the being an intern part was cool. I got to learn a lot. I got to talk to a lot of people. It was another opportunity to expand my networks and learn. And a lot of independent work, right? It wasn't like going into an office and having to do it. Like, I chose a company that I knew would be giving me interesting work, not like going working somewhere huge where I would just be like some having to do the picking up the coffee or whatever interns do. And to be fair, I've had some interns that are great, and I always treat my interns great. So I think like it's intern karma that I had a good one, that I ended up with a good internship. And so I've worked on this study, this research on emissions in the industry, and it just made me realize how difficult the task is, right? Like to do this. There's so many different activities, such a diverse range of stakeholders who partake in different activities that have different impacts. So it's, you know, very hard to come up with a framework to measure everybody's activities. So you really have to look at it from different stakeholder groups, which kind of is like the foundation of my thesis now. It's like, how do you get different stakeholder groups to all sign onto this together and have different ways for different stakeholders to do the work? Because it's so different.
Which stakeholder do you feel or have you observed is like the most difficult to kind of achieve that with?
Well, so on the positive side, you know, music festivals are kind of leading the way here, right? There's a lot of festivals around Europe, specifically in Europe too, that are focusing on reducing waste, on, you know, audience transportation, on renewable energy generation, on plant-based food, on all the things that you need to do to be a sustainable festival. There's a big movement of that in Europe. There's even a alliance or a pledge called the Green Deal Circular Festivals that's led by the Dutch government and Green Events in the Netherlands, but has expanded to 40 plus festivals around Europe. And so festivals are doing a great job, right? And that's starting here in the US a bit, in North America a bit. And the record labels have all signed on to this music climate, or not all, many have signed on to this music climate pact, which was facilitated by Impala, which is the independent music association in Europe, that calls for and sets a time frame for reducing emissions and then reaching net zero emissions. We could argue about if it's ambitious enough or not, but they're doing something, which is great. And they're doing it collectively, which is even better. And you know, artists, we have DJs for Climate Action. We have a lot of artists speaking out. We have Bye Bye Plastic, which was started by Blondish. We have artists doing a lot of work around this as well. So what we're really missing is the support of the agents and managers, right? Who often work for bigger companies. So we're dealing with like CAA or like William Morris, who are these massive corporations. So it's a lot harder, right? It's not as grassroots as a lot of what we're looking at in the electronic music industry. So harder to make this influence, but there's such an essential piece of this, right? Because artists can ask to tour a certain way or to ask to have certain policies in place, but unless their management or agents are really understand and committed to doing it, it's not going to happen, because they're the ones who are working, interfacing with the promoters and the venues and the festivals where the artists are playing. Furthermore, like, there's a lot of influence that these agents and managers or company agencies can have over newer artists, right, who are just starting out, rather than just immediately putting them through the spin cycle, you know, flying them back and forth across the world constantly. There's a way that's much more sustainable for the planet, for the environment, for the climate, but also for artists' mental health and for the longevity of their careers and physical health and the longevity of their careers. The way that we do things is just not sustainable in so many ways.
Mm. So what are the three things a promoter and a fan and an artist can do every time they go either to a party or they organize a party? And we can break that down into each group.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's holistic things, right? There's like really focusing on your local scene, whether you're an artist and that means playing more shows where you live, whether you're a fan and that means, you know, supporting those artists who are more, you know, maybe not as high profile, like not going to see whatever the big DJ is that's flying in that weekend, but going to the cooler, more underground, more local party. And that's, you know, that's on the positive side, that's happening so much in New York these days, you know, and I kind of see it in other places too, Berlin, London, like these bigger hubs. Obviously there's still these huge international DJs coming in all the time, but it seems like the grassroots is as strong as it's been in a long time. And part of that is just necessity coming out of the pandemic, right? That it was an opportunity for venues to see that they could book local artists and people would go out, right? And so, because everyone was just so excited to be out at the club again. So that's a piece of it. But also that's harder with bigger festivals, right? They're trying to sell an enormous number of tickets. So they have to book these headliners in order to compete with the other festivals, right? So, but it's something to really keep in mind. And if we can continue to push in that direction as an industry and, you know, push the culture that way, there can be a significant impact made on the emissions of artists flying, but also on, you know, looking at music fans not getting on an airplane to fly to a festival, but, you know, looking at festivals in your home country, in your home city, in your area, instead of flying, right? And it's kind of a catch-22, right? Because if artists aren't traveling, and there's an artist you really want to see that's only playing at this festival far away, then maybe you feel like you have to travel there. So we have to find a balance, right? Like just not touring is not going to solve it. So that's something that, but like thinking about the culture and really just valuing the local scenes is a positive step. So second thing, we're looking at how different groups can make an impact, right? Is what you said?
Yeah. Every time they go to a party or they organize one, like what are those steps?
Right. So, you know, these local lineups, local and diverse lineups, right? We want to make sure we're shining the light on artists from all different communities and backgrounds and being open to different genres, right? So you can learn about music and also support different things and different cultures is so important. So beyond that, I would say that really pushing for no single-use plastics is something that I think everybody has the power over. And we're so close to this one. This is like, we're really nearing the cultural tipping point here where it's just not acceptable, right? So like, if you go to a venue and they have plastic, to like say something about it, you know, like if you're a fan, right? If you're an artist, you can have a green rider. A lot of artists have this. It's not always effective because if this venue hasn't moved away from single use plastic, it's really hard for them to do that just for the night you're performing. But if enough artists are doing this, that also leads to this cultural shift, right? And that's happening. That's all happening. And if you're a venue, you know, in most major cities now, there's many options, right? There's like these reusable cup companies that will drop off cups every weekend and then pick them up and wash them for you and then bring them back. And there's a lot of options. So it's maybe just about doing a little work to find out what's available near you and what can work for your business model. And I know it's hard for venues, right? It's like, it's especially post-pandemic, a lot of venues, smaller and medium venues especially, are operating on a shoestring budget. So any cost incurred can, you know, kill the business. So it's about us working together to figure out how to get venues these resources so they can see what's available where they're in the cities where they're located, maybe for financial support or grants, and really work on that. That's something I'm working on right now in New York to see how we can support venues moving away from single-use plastics and being more sustainable in general. And, you know, shout out to Bye Bye Plastic again. They have a lot of great work around this, as well as Oceanic Global, who has something called the Blue Standard, which offers a ton of support for venues. So yeah, I mean, that's the kind of top line. There's obviously so much that can happen around waste management, around renewable energy, but that's much like more behind the scenes, I guess, or more technical. And then the third thing, I mean, I guess it connects to the first thing, but there's so much we can do around more efficient and thoughtful routing when we are traveling as artists. That's something that's essential. Like for our most recent Soul Club tour, in the spring and summer of last year. We really worked with our management, our agents to like really focus making it as regional as possible. So, you know, all of our West Coast dates were over 2 weeks. West Coast of the US dates or of North America dates were over 2 weekends. So you fly, you have one long haul flight and then you're taking the train or driving, or maybe, you know, when you have to fly, when it's a longer distance, it's still a much shorter flight and it's no connections. So the impact of a direct flight is much smaller than a connecting flight. So that's something to keep in mind also. So that routing, you know, can play a big role in reducing emissions. Or like going to Europe, you know, we went to Europe once and we took the train for the majority of our gigs in Europe. It takes work. It takes more work. And this is why I say agents and managers are so essential here, because they need to be committed to this, because it's more work to route efficiently than it is to just fly all over the place and take whatever gig is going to offer the most money on whatever weekend without considering the travel. But I know from experience how awful it is when you like have the gigs booked and then you go to look at flights and you're like, wow, I'm taking two connections to get from point A to point C or D, whatever it is. And this weekend now is going to be so exhausting and I don't even get home until Tuesday. Like that's tough. That's like really hard for an artist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, people have really evaluated, you know, pre-pandemic, it felt like it was just the machine and the system. But then like post-pandemic, everyone had time to breathe and was like, you know, is this really the path that I want to do in this kind of way, right? You mentioned like, you know, sometimes the resistance point is the agent or the manager. Could we not argue that if the artist is big enough, you know, why couldn't they put that pressure on? And why, if the resistance is just not cutting through, like why couldn't you just move to another agent? Like, is it that simple? Like, oh, can you just move to another manager or an agent? Because if you're in demand, like surely people be bidding to like work with you and your vision.
I don't know if we have seen a high profile enough artist make this commitment yet. So I call on more artists, you know, to make this step. I would say like, you know, I'm definitely mid-range, right? As a profile wise, you know, so it's different for me than somebody who's like top tier private jet DJ. And I know that a lot of it is there can be a lot of fear about backlash on social media because it's can feel hypocritical, right? You're flying all the time and you're talking about how you're trying to make a positive impact, but you're still flying all the time. But like the reality is that this is the system that we're dealt as artists, right? The reality is that if you look at the impacts of the music industry, flying and artist travel is not the biggest impact anyway. It's audience travel is the biggest impact of the music industry, right? And there's a lot of, you know, there's other impacts that are bigger than the artist traveling, because you're still talking about such a small percentage of the people who are operating the industry who are traveling like that. I mean, streaming, music streaming has an insane carbon footprint, right? Like it's huge. So, and it's bigger than it ever was with CDs or records, even though those are physical products, just because of the amount of energy that's required to operate the servers and the data transfer. On top of that, creating the devices that we use to stream music also has massive impacts on the environment and the climate, right? So how do we, you know, work on changing that system? That's another thing to think about. So it's just putting it on artists' flights because it's easy because, right, artists are the public facing part of the industry, artists fly a lot. And look, yes, like we should not be standing for culturally private jets. Like that's got to go, right? Like, and it's going to cut into some people's profits a little bit, right? Because you can't go and play two or three shows in one day if you're not flying private. But, you know, if you're making millions and millions a year from your music, I would call on you to take a step back and do some soul searching and ask if you really need to do that extra show on the private jet. Does that actually make you happier? Right. So it's a hard conversation to have. Right. And like, I also don't blame anybody or hold it against anybody. We all have our own stories and we all have our own priorities. And, you know, it's easy for me to say, like, I'm you know, I'm comfortable. I come from a family that already, I come from some generational wealth, right? So I'm not as like, how am I gonna make sure my kids are sorted, right? Like, so I totally understand that some, for some people, financial concerns are gonna go higher, but like, let's at least think about it, talk about it, do some soul searching and really think about what we really need. And that's why I say cultural shift, right? Like, it's important that we can have these conversations without blaming people or like, or canceling people or whatever you want to say about or yelling at each other. Mm. These are just like, it's so nuanced and everybody's got their own story. We can't expect everybody to live the same way.
Of course, of course. And I mean, I think a lot of these issues like also arise from like the design not being kind of like the right way, you know, in the beginning. So like, it's much harder to change a system or a, you know, a concept once it's off the ground and all the infrastructure is in place. But like, if you design better from the get-go and spend more time kind of like getting to that point, then hopefully, or, you know, theoretically longer term, you'll have much less impact negatively on the planet. So, you know, you mentioned there about like the streaming impact, the impact from streaming. And I think, you know, your general day-to-day fan like just wouldn't realize or know that. So like, could you shed some light on a bit of that? And like, what are also some of the ways that we can help combat this?
Yeah, so there's a great book called Decomposed, The Political Ecology of Music by Kyle Devine, which is kind of all about the history of the production of music, like how you physically would listen to it through shellac, which was pre-vinyl, to vinyl, which has, you know, its own very negative impacts on the planet, to CDs and then through to streaming. And so he's done a lot of work kind of comparing the different eras as well. So there's a lot of great information in there. The vinyl thing, you know, is not, the physical obviously is not the be all end all solution either. However, there's a lot of great things happening in that space. There's a company called Green Vinyl, which has a new process, which injection molds a PVC free plastic, like a much less bad impact plastic, into like a mold rather than using a traditional vinyl press. So it has significantly less, something like 70 or 80% less energy consumption, plus it's using a better material. PVC plastic is like mostly produced in Thailand and has this huge environmental impacts on the workers who make it. And then also on the land where it's being polluted from producing this plastic. And then there's another one, which is also super interesting, which is Evolution Music. They're based in the UK and they are developing bioplastics, or they have developed a bioplastic that can be used in traditional vinyl presses that is made from plants. So it is a great solution for pressing records that hopefully we can push for uptake in the industry as fast as possible now that it's here. So a lot of it is like supporting these things is like, when things appear is like, how do you get behind it? You know, what's exciting? If you're a vinyl fan, you know, and you buy a lot of records, there's like, this is a great way to get involved in climate action is check out Evolution Music, check out what they're doing and see how you can help put the pressure on for more of the labels that you love or the plants, or, you know, the labels that you love to press at pressing plants that start using this material. You know, this is a positive thing about social media, you know, talk about the negative of the yelling at each other thing, but this is a positive that we can have a dialogue with the musicians and the labels that we love on social media, you know, especially if it's positive, that's going to make people want to do things, not yelling at them. So the streaming thing is difficult, right? Because it's got these huge impacts and it also doesn't support artists having a real livelihood. So, but it's also completely entrenched, right? It's like huge corporation. Basically the major labels own this, own Spotify and mm-hmm. Apple owns Apple Music. So we've got this situation where we're as artists unable to make a living. And at the same time, our music getting streamed has this huge negative impact. But at the same time, we still need our music to be streamed in order for people to know about us and then want to book us to travel, which also has another impact, right? So there's a lot of ways that I think, you know, the pandemic had people rethinking stuff, you know, things like subscription models, like Bandcamp, building a community on Bandcamp. You know, it's less impact to download music and then listen to it than to stream music.
Because
you only have that one time when you're actually using energy to download it. So whereas every time you stream, it's getting pulled from servers somewhere or in outer space, wherever they are. So that's something you can do, you know, as an artist, really try to build that community. There's this great philosophy called the 1,000 true fans model, which is like, if you have 1,000 hardcore supporters of you as a musician, artist, writer, whatever it is, who will pay $100 a year for your something that you're producing, whether that's a monthly subscription or you make one really special thing or a couple things, then you're making a really, you know, you're making a decent salary doing your art or creative enterprise. So, you know, even that is hard to reach, right? 1,000 people are going to pay $100 for something that you're making, but that feels much more attainable, right? And like much more like something you can set as a goal and work towards than being like, oh, I just need to get my song streamed as much as possible on Spotify, so like not enough people know about me that they're going to book me to play shows. So I think just like with all of this, it's this like rethinking our culture in ways that are slower and more community-based and more grounded is how we're going to really make progress for ourselves and then for the broader community and industry.
And how can music fans put more pressure on the DSPs to move away from these highly entrenched systems?
Exploitative models.
Yes.
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know. Like it doesn't feel like there's much we can do about corporate practices. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I always, rather than getting caught up in that, I try to just find alternative models and support people who are doing interesting things around it. And the more that we can support them, the more things that pop up, the more people that are learning about it, that are trying it, eventually those networks become strong enough where it's a real alternative that doesn't require participating in that other system.
Yeah. And I think continuing the conversation is like really important, because like you just don't know what you don't know, right? And like people just don't, maybe we're in the music industry, so we're like super like, you know, on the news and on industry news and like aware of things because it affects our ecosystem and the way we transact, the way we make money. But like your day-to-day fan just wouldn't know, you know, so this is the thing. Now, Soul Collab Records is also one of the most prolific labels in the scene, so congrats. And so as an artist and label owner, what do you think is like one of the number one habits that artists need to adopt to succeed in making their music, number one, and then number two, like getting signed?
Well, first of all, Soul Collab Records, we're celebrating 11 years of the label. Actually, this month we released a compilation of remixes from the back catalog called the 11th Anniversary Remix Compilation. That is really exciting. We were going to celebrate 10 years, but things got in the way last year, so we're here 11 years. And I think, you know, it's so hard, it's so much harder, I think, than when I was coming up. Like I said, when, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there just weren't that many DJs. But even when we like got our break and started traveling, there were so many less DJs and so many less producers and so much less noise and so much less that you know, so much more time, I feel like you had to focus on just your music than all these other things. But I feel like that's like still the most important thing. It's like focus on the music. Don't get caught up in like, I made this one track, I'm going to send it to everybody right now. It's like, get that body of music. Keep making that music. Exercise the muscle. Get a 50 tracks, 100 tracks, 200 tracks under your belt before you even start trying to get it out there. You know, like, be ready. So when something hits, you know, you're ready to roll with it. And also, like, you never know when that faucet dries up. One, like you can have creative, you can have like writer block spells, one, or you just start getting successful and you don't have as much time because you're traveling or playing a lot of gigs. Like so many artists I talk to, it's like, it's kind of one or the other. If you're playing every weekend, Monday's recovery day, maybe you get back in the studio by Tuesday, then by Friday you're leaving again. So you get 3 days to really focus. And like, I think, like I said, it's the muscle. So it's gotta be like, when you're really trying to write and like be creative, you gotta do it close to every day to really grow. So that's like, that's my biggest advice. I mean, I think obviously it's so important to have your public image and build that and think about that. But like, I would love to see artists and like, you know, that newer, even newer artists that the newer artists that I love are the ones who committed that time in the studio first. And then things started happening and then they blew up because they were ready.
Definitely. Yeah. Some great advice. You know, and definitely I think it's true about, you know, consistency, right? Consistency is what always leads to results. And that's really important. Cause as you and say,
patience, right? Like that's like kind of the word there, right? It's like consistency and patience. And that's something that we learned early on, right? Like we were kind of excited in a rush at moments, but had some really good advice from some mentors that were like, just don't rush it.
And then, you know, as a label owner, obviously, like you obviously must get loads of demos and stuff. So how do you think it works with you guys? Like, is it a case of like, do you genuinely sign stuff that's like coming in cold from an email, or are you mainly going on like people who have come through your network and like suggesting, you know, the label family and stuff? Or are you open to cold emails? And if you are, what are some of those best practices that artists can have in submitting their pitch to you guys and labels in general?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we rarely get cold emails that bear any fruit. I think it's like, often I just feel like people are just finding any contact for every record label and just sending the music out. Right. If your music doesn't fit the label, then don't send your music to the label. It just means that the labels don't listen to anything. That for me is something, but like, it is definitely from networks, you know, like any, you know, more recently, like we signed an artist from Turkey named Zeynep Erbe, and she's a, you know, newer producer, but that came through a friend, you know. Or I remember like getting one cold email with some music, but that was from Midnight Magic, who was already like one of my favorite newer disco bands. And they had, you know, just reached out because they were fans of the label at that time. So it's hard though, if there's nothing, if you don't have a resume already, just cold sending demos to labels, right? Like, I don't know. That's kind of highlights this difficulty, right? How do you start if you don't have the connections, but how do you have the connections if you don't start?
Chicken and egg. So,
yeah. I mean, it's gotta be, you know, going out, building community. And you know, I see more and more artists just putting out music themselves too, to start, like not even signing to a label. With Bandcamp, you can really do that. You can build off Bandcamp, right? Like you can just put your music out there and maybe you get something that some people start sharing, or, you know, somebody finds that has followers and they play it, and then other people get into it. And then you have some kind of resume that you can share with, you know, a potential label that you want to sign with. But I also think, like, when we were starting a Soul Club, and I think this still stands so true, it's like, what labels do you love? What labels are you playing their music? Send your music to them. Even if they don't hear it, even if they don't respond, like, that's what's more likely that's going to get a response, right? Like, I remember for us, like, Ebonon Records was one of our favorites back in the day. We sent our music there. We never got a response, but it was just exciting. We're like, yo, this is our one of our favorite labels right now. We're going to send our music here. Maybe they'll listen to it. Maybe they'll respond. Whatever, they didn't. We ended up finding other pathways. But I think, like, really focusing, not just like, we'll cast the net wide. Like, this is music. Like, you have things that you love. You should be making music that you love and that fits some vision that you know, from what you're influenced by. And if it doesn't, then start your own label. Be like, this is my vision. I don't give a fuck. This is what I do.
100%, 100%. Now, I think it all comes back down to, you know, consciously and selectively choosing labels you pitch to, but B, obviously developing those relationships, and that takes time and energy and effort, but, you know, you only get what you sow, right? So you can't expect all of those results just, you know, just by sending out emails.
I think one more thing on that point, which is like, it makes, and this is to this day, it makes such a difference when you're contacting people and not asking for something.
Yeah.
Building relationships is so important that like when I get a DM on Instagram, that's just like, listen to my music from somebody, I have no idea who they are. I'm never going to listen to the music. When I get a DM, it's like, you know, I really love what you do with the label. I really love what you do. You know, what's this track you played in a mix? I'm always going to respond. And then maybe, you know, after a few DMs, they'll be like, I'm making music too. Do you have time to listen to it? And then I'm always going to say yes. Right. Because that's like, they hit me up, like asking for something that wasn't like, not asking for something that's going to help their career, but just like as a human, like, hey, you know, like, here's something that we can connect on. This is a song we both love. And that's something that to this day, like, I'm always maintaining relationships, like just saying hi, wishing happy birthday, doing these things, because every few years you need to ask somebody for something, right? But if every time you're hitting them up is like, can you do this for me? They're going to stop responding. And I know, because I'm the same, right? Like, I'm not like, if it's, I have those relationships that have fallen off because people just kept hitting me up asking for something. I'm like, I thought we were friends, right? I didn't think I was just here to always, you know, help you with something.
Yeah. I so agree. It's a value exchange. And it's like, also it should be earned over time. It's not like, demand what you have and just give it outright. Right. Like, that's crazy. But that kind of goes quite nicely into the next kind of point, which is like, yeah, the 1,000 true fans. I love that model as well. I think it, you know, it's very powerful thing to understand. And there's so much value unlocking that you can do and understanding how to leverage those 1,000 true fans and building that. So like, as you've kind of obviously gone along, you know, more than 2 decades in the scene, the technology's changed, the pressure points have changed, the hats that you need to wear have changed as well. So like, what are kind of some of your top tips in like building that audience, you know, building that fan base?
I mean, I think for me, so much of it now is tied into the other work I do, or like the values that I try to share beyond just the music I'm putting out, or like through the music I'm putting out. Like, I think that's such a piece of it. It's like building this, and it's the 1,000 true fans, like building community, not just building a fan base. I think that's like where we need to be. Like, when we're talking about electronic music, like the roots of this music are in community, right? The roots of this music are not in the current, you know, corporate system that we have, which is great. You know, the industry makes over $8 billion a year. It's amazing. So many people are living off this music, and that's an incredible thing. But I think, like, you know, maybe I'm just like a idealist or a hippie or whatever it is. Like, to me, what's still the most important is the community. And that's what makes electronic music unique, is you're not just going to a concert and watching a band. You know, you're going to a party where there's an exchange of energy between the DJ and the dancers. And like, the best DJs are the ones who are dancing, or the ones who are going to come out on the dance floor after their set or whatever it is, because that's the, like, the true spirit of this. And even in a huge party, there's still that exchange, I do feel like, you know. And about the people you're meeting and connecting with. And look, of course that can happen at a concert too. Like, the bands are putting out so much, and that's a beautiful thing too, but it's different. It's different. We came from, you know, creating spaces for mostly Black and Brown gay men to come together and like have a safe place to just exist. That's what our music comes from, right? Like, initially. And that expanded quickly to like a whole number of different groups and people going to these parties. But like, you know, it's about creating this community and creating spaces where people feel safe and feel like they can be themselves around the music. So I don't know, that's a kind of roundabout answer to this, but that's it. And it goes back to building the local scenes and focusing on local and setting your goals at being like building that first. And sure, maybe you get to travel, but like, and that's amazing when you do, but putting the value on having an amazing party in your city where you can see all your friends when you throw that party is a really great starting point.
Yeah, definitely. And so what do you think are some of the misconceptions behind some of the work that you do?
Misconceptions. I mean, there's a thing about flying. That's a huge one, right? Where we hold DJs to this insane standard where they can't fly to do our jobs. Like, that's ridiculous. And when like no one's willing to sacrifice flying at all, right? Like, we all have to take a look at like what our behaviors are in order to sign this, solve this climate thing and like survive as a species, we have to take a real look at what our behaviors are and what, you know, how we can grow and change in ways that are gonna benefit ourselves, our communities, and the planet, and our, you know, humans in general. And so, you know, we're gonna have to cut back flying. It's the reality, and that's not like a good thing to hear, but it's like not fair to just put that on DJs right now, right? Like let's all think about how we can change the system together. So that's a misconception, right? That it's just on artists to do this. It's on everybody to do this. It's on the whole industry to do this. And I guess that's like a big, that's a big few of them together in one.
For sure. What's a greenwashing trend that makes you roll your eyes?
Oh man, the worst, this is kind of a nerdy climate policy one, but you know, for every year there's a United Nations Conference of the Parties, which is a big conference of all the different countries and people who've signed on to the UN climate agreement. You know, COP, they call it COP, COP, and they have a number next to it. And it's, you know, I think a lot of people know about COP at this point, right? Because it's all over the news now when they have COP conferences. And the reality though is that, you know, fossil fuel companies, you know, there's thousands of people that go to these, and it's like a huge convention almost. And like you have fossil fuel companies and Coca-Cola sponsoring the COP conference of the party and like, you know, climate conference, which is insane, right? So like, and even the UN is like co-opted by corporate interests.
Yeah.
It really illustrates how difficult and entrenched the system is, and how hard it's going to be to you know, move past for real climate action.
For sure, yeah. Especially when you hear like companies like BP are making record profits, and where is that going back to? You know, it's very hard to fight the power players in the system. So what do you think are some of the most important change marks? Like if we looked at it from a sort of 1 year, 5 year, 10 year perspective, like where would you see those kind of important flag points being put
yeah, into? Yeah. Yeah. So like, let's say 1 year we can sign on as an electronic music industry. I'll be specific here because it's the work that I'm doing right now. Is like 1 year we can set, but we could take this and kind of look at any industry or any sector or any business or any individual, right? Like 1 year is like measuring what our impacts are. And 5 years is, or, and 5 years is having like the first goal of how we're going to reduce our impacts, how we're going to do better in a number of different ways. Like obviously the easiest way to measure impacts is with emissions, right? Like how much carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases we're emitting as a sector, as a business, as an individual into the atmosphere, which is what's causing climate change. But we can also look at that in a number of other ways. Like, you know, how are we impacting our community positively or negatively? How are we impacting the environment where we live or by the events that we're organizing positively or negatively? You know, how, and then looking at that 5 years is setting goals for those 5 years and then reaching them. So that being the, you know, reducing emissions by some significant number in 5 years, the like, UN goal is for everybody to cut their emissions in half by 2030. That's all businesses, all individuals, everything, cutting the emissions in half by 2030. Then by 2050 is net zero, whole other conversation, but that means that basically emissions are balanced at zero by 2050. So like, it's a longer scale, but that's kind of what we're looking. 5 years, we're getting close to 2030. So I'd say we want to be cutting our emissions in half. We also want to be in 5 years making sure we're more engaged with our community, maybe have an organization or a group of people that we're working with on making our local scene, our local neighborhood, our local town, city, whatever it is, doing something that's going to have a positive impact on the climate and the environment. That's a great goal for 5 years, right? Like tangible success with that, like tangible actions that have been taken. And looking at the industry, it's like 5 years. Yeah. How are we taking the, are we starting to take these steps? Are we valuing the moving away from travel? Are we doing better when we do travel? Are we building alternatives to the streaming platforms? Are we providing artists with better livelihoods? Are we, you know, giving a platform to more diverse artists? All these things that are so, so intertwined for this. And then 10 years, I mean, look, hopefully we have the system has changed and we're all living in this beautiful utopian music system where artists make enough to live and they don't have to get on airplanes when they don't want to. And people are having smaller, more sustainable festivals closer to their homes and enjoying music and each other even more than we do now.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. What are some of the things that you're like, I mean, you obviously mentioned like the thesis, that's like a massive, massive thing. But what does this year kind of like hold for you? Like, what are you looking forward to?
Yeah. So, well, this has been exciting with the 11 years of Soul Clap Records celebration. We have a release party in New York at the end of the month on the 25th. And then several dates around the country. But for me, more than anything, 2023 is this opportunity to put my money where my mouth is, I guess, and not fly.
Mm-hmm.
I am like minimizing my flights for gigs. I am going to be playing the majority of my gigs in New York, at Philadelphia, DC, Boston, upstate near where I live, because these are all places I can get to by train or by car, which has a smaller impact. And, you know, even Detroit, I can get to by train, where I'm going to be doing a show in May, and like really focusing on this. So this is a big change and like kind of a experiment to see if I can still make a living practicing what I preach. So come talk to me in February 2024 and let's see how it turned out. But it's also a big step for Soul Clap because it means my partner Charlie is going to be doing most of the Soul Clap gigs solo, but as Soul Clap. And we've never done that before. We've always kind of had to be both of us. So this was like a kind of new experiment for us as a partnership as well. So that's cool.
Mm. Yes, very true. How does your agent feel about the local touring? Has it been easy to get that support within your team?
The reality of that is that I have to do a lot of that booking myself. Like, it's kind of back on me, back to how it was when I was first starting, because it's about my relationships that have been built in these places. And because the fees are going to be smaller, there's more of that money has to go in my pocket, right? So look, agents still happily booking Soul Clap shows. And I don't know how they feel about me doing all these shows on my own. They probably don't love it, but you know, I have strong beliefs, so I got to stick up for them.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got to put your money where your mouth is, as you say. And there's obviously a lot of change coming as well with like the new baby and all that stuff. So definitely, is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to use this space to talk about?
I think this we covered a lot of ground on the music industry and climate stuff. So I think we did great. Thanks so much.
Amazing. Well, really great to have you here on Mission Makers, and keep up all of that work. It's super important. We'll also, you mentioned quite a few good resources, so we'll definitely link those back. And if your thesis becomes public, we'll love to link that back in as well and share that out for our community.
Yeah, well, and you know, one more shout out, which is with DJs for Climate Action, we have our 6th annual Earth Night event series, which takes place on the weekend closest to Earth Day, which this year is April 21st through 23rd. And we have an open call out right now to any DJs, promoters, venues that want to organize an Earth Night event to raise awareness and funds for climate action in the community or the industry. So it's a great opportunity to get involved if it's something that people are interested in.
Amazing. And so what does that look like, you know, from a promoter's perspective? Like, is there like a certain format, like an evening has to follow, or is it mainly like raising funds for this day? Like, what is it? Yeah. Require?
Yeah. There's kind of like a certain pillars. So one of them would be one option. And like, we ask for people to do, you know, as many as they can, but it's still pretty open. So like one option is raising funds for a local organization, or DJs for Climate Action. We're a totally volunteer run organization that does a lot of important work. Another one is booking an all local and diverse lineup, like we talked about. Another one is no single use plastics at the venue for that event, and ideally forever. Another one is looking at options around renewable energy and plant-based food and local food, if these are things that you're using at your venue. And I guess those are the major ones. So it's just all about trying to embody this action with an event.
Amazing. Really cool. Well, we'll definitely plug that in as well and see what we can get going in London from our end.
Thanks, Farah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Eli. Wishing you a great kind of month ahead, and thanks for jumping on.
Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed having these conversations. If you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com, where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. And if you're interested in talking to me about producing podcasts or coming down to my music and motorsports events, then you can reach out to me at missionmakers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram. The music played in today's episode is an exclusive preview of my upcoming track, Infinite Being, with Deepak Chopra, and it will be coming out early next year. This has been a Mission Makers production. Thank you as ever for listening. And until next time, keep it laser focused.
We're not talking about mind, which is a modified expression of what we call the self. Self is fundamental reality, fundamental being. We call ourselves human beings, not human thinkers, or not human doings, but human beings. So right now, as you're listening to me, if you were just try this, as you're listening to me, be aware of that which is listening.